The Rambam, my mind is, who was born, let's say 1135, some say 1138, it's interesting. Disagreement on that, but let's say 1135. He wrote Pirush Mishnayot when he was in his 20s, and they say he finished it, let's say when he was in his early 30s, sometime approximately the year, like maybe 1168, he finished his commentary on the Mishnah. The Mishnah is the compendium of Jewish law. Till today, that's the official primary compendium of Jewish law, although we don't take halakha from the Mishnah, we take halakha from Shulchan Aruch, a much later compendium. The Mishnah was compiled in the year 200, say finalized in the year 200, the Common Era, 1800 years ago. And then you have the Gemara commentary on it. Through the Gemara commentary, we have many arguments about what the Mishnah means. And in those arguments, we have a lot more insight into the Mishnah. But we decided, the Jewish nation decided early on, that we're not going to posek halacha straight from the Mishnah, we're going to use the Gemara and its discussions and its arguments and how to interpret it, and we'll use the Gemara to help us in halacha, and then it's very difficult to derive halacha from there. So subsequently, rabbis wrote commentaries on the Mishnah. After the Rambam's days, there were continuation of discussion on what the Rambam is saying in his Pirush Mishnah. Anyway, that was his first substantial work, Talmudic work of the Rambam, which, as I said, was completed in his early days. A little bit later, when he was, say, in his 40s, mid-40s, he completed his compendium, which he started maybe from when he was 35 years old till he's about 45 years old. It took about 10 years. 10 years he was in isolation for a big part of that 10 years. He was even wanted for a while. There was things. And he spent 10 years of full time writing Mishneh Torah. That's his compendium of halakha. That was the first major comprehensive halakha code that the Jewish people had after the Mishnah, but this was different than the Mishnah. This one actually gave you halakha and maaseh, what you can do. That was Mishneh Torah. Subsequently, he wrote another very major work, which is called The Guide to the Perplexed. He wrote that a few years later, and by that time, he was, let's say in 1890, that might have been completed somewhere around there. So, and he passed away 1204. So there was a short period of time between the completion of The Guide to the Perplexed and his passing away, maybe 14 years or so. And that's a very interesting subject itself, where he didn't write any more compendiums. He had those three, but there's medical writings of the Rambam, and then there's letters. And anyway, this, I'm telling you now what my introduction is really to my next week lecture about the Rambam changing his mind on some subjects, which goes from earlier to mid to later and so on. But what's important for tonight is that when he was young, in the Pirush HaMishnah, which we're going to read a selection from now, he wrote this great introduction to the Mishnah, which has been put in separate volumes. Like this comes from a separate volume that just has introduction to the Rambam. His Mishnah commentaries. If you look at the front page of what's photographed here, it says Introduction to Seder Zira'im. Seder Zira'im is one of the six major divisions of Mishnah, Zira'im, and the Rambam wrote this major introduction to Mishnah. It's called Introduction to Seder Zira'im. A lot of interesting things in there that are relevant to tonight's lecture. But since we have to limit ourselves, because we're going to be working on this subject for an hour or so, so we're going to do his, in the Pirush HaMishnah, his introduction to the 10th chapter of Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin is part of the order of Mishnah, one of the six orders which is called Nezikin. It has to do with damages and business matters. That's one of the six orders. And In Nezikin, the Rambam has introduction to this particular chapter, and the reason he wrote introduction to this 10th chapter of Sanhedrin is because that chapter, more than any other chapter in the Talmud, in the Gemara now, not in the Mishnah, but the Mishnah lends itself a little bit to it, it has a tremendous amount of agadot. What are agadot? They're what we say, tales related. The word agadah comes from the Hagid, to Haggadah is to relate. On Pesach we have the Haggadah. Haggadah is the relating. The Torah tells us that on that night of Passover, you should relate to your children all about what God did for the Jewish people in taking them out of Egypt. That's called the Haggadah Levencha Ve'Yom HaHulamor, that day, what God did for us. So we call it Haggadah. And Agadot, with an aleph in the front instead of a hair, it's the noun that refers to this whole genre of literature, of rabbinic expounding of the text of Tanakh and of all kind of, good evening, and of all kinds of ideas. And that is found in the 10th chapter of Sanhedrin, perhaps more than any other place in the Talmud, as far as some very mystical concepts that have to do with the Mashiach, that have to do with the resurrection, that have to do with the 10 lost tribes. These things are all found in the 10th chapter of Sanhedrin. So the Rambam chose that chapter to write a special introduction to, even though he had written an introduction that to some extent covers some of the topics previously to the Pope. But this one is looked at as focusing right on the topic of Midrash itself. And when I say Midrash and Agadah, we really use them synonymously. We just differentiate by saying the Talmudic statements that are expounding non-legal matters are called Agadah. And when they're non-Talmudic, we'll call it Midrash. There are many non-Talmudic compendiums that the rabbis wrote aside from the Talmud, subsequently to the Talmud. There are many which are called Midrash. There's on the Hamashim of the Torah, there's Midrash Rabbah, like Bereshit Rabbah, Shemot Rabbah, then there's Tanhumah, and there are other collections of Midrash. And tonight's subject is the Rambam and Midrash. So first we'll read what he says. I gave you just a little introduction to place this in a perspective. Let's look at we should give out those. We'll look at the handwritten page 12. And we're going to start the second column, which in this text is page 407. See at the top, it says Helek. That's what we call this chapter, Helek. It comes from the phrase, Kol Yisrael Yesh Lahem Helek Le'olam Haba. All Israel have a portion to the world to come, except those that deny certain principles. So now, that's what it says in the Mishnah. And the Rambam's commenting on that. Chapter 10 of Sanhedrin. So we'll start one paragraph down. You must know that the words of the sages are differently interpreted by three groups of people. We're not going to read all that much. The first group is the largest one. I've observed them, read their books, and heard about them. They accept the teachings of the sages in their simple, literal sense and do not think that these teachings contain any hidden meaning at all. They believe that all sorts of impossible things must be. They hold such opinions because they have not understood science and are far from having acquired knowledge. They possess no perfection which would rouse them to insight from within, nor have they found anyone else to stimulate them to profound understanding. They therefore believe that the sages intended no more in their carefully emphatic and straightforward utterances than they themselves are able to understand with inadequate knowledge. They understand the teachings of the sages only in their literal sense, in spite of the fact that some of their teachings, when taken literally, seem so fantastic and irrational that if one were to repeat them literally, even to the uneducated, let alone to sophisticated scholars, the amazement would prompt them to ask how anyone in the world could believe such things true, much less edifying. Like, I'll just give you one example that you should get an idea. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu, when they were in the battle with Og Melech HaBashan, it says Moshe Rabbeinu was 10 amot tall, and amah is anywhere between 18 to 24 inches. That's an amah. It's the forearm of a man. So they say Moshe Rabbeinu was 10 amot tall. So if you say it's a foot and a half, so he's 15 feet tall. And he jumped 10 amot. And he had with him a powerful club of 10 amot long. And he swiped and he got Og in the ankle, maybe the Achilles heel, you would say. He got him over there and he killed him. He has tremendous strength, Moshe. This is what the rabbis say. Now, anybody who reads this statement knows that we're not talking about a literal concept that Moshe was able to get up 30 and that you only reach Org's ankle. Now, this is not to be taken literally. Good evening. The late comers, Rabbi Azancourt called that he was not able to be here tonight due to he had a tooth extraction and he couldn't speak. He went to Dr. Aza, right? He copied. So, it happened just to be today that your secretary did call to me to make an appointment to remind me. Anyway, that's an example. Og Melech HaBashan, that he would be, how tall would you say, if you take the average person from his ankle to his head, how big must Og really be? So the Rambam in this statement, now we're talking about the first of three groups. The members of this group are poor in knowledge. One can only regret their folly, the bottom paragraph. Their very effort to honor and to exalt the sages in accordance with their own meager understanding actually humiliates them. As God lives, this group destroys the glory of the Torah and extinguishes its light, for they make the Torah of God say the opposite of what it intended. These are very strong words. You know, the Rambam is talking about people that some of us know very well. People who take these literally. But these are very powerful words, because
maybe they say he didn't really write it.
No, nobody questions that. This is, they have today handwritten copies of the Rambam's Pirush HaMishnayot. They have handwritten copies proven to be the Rambam's, known to be the Rambam's. They were in the family possession by his son, and they've studied the handwriting of the Rambam. They found original emendations, crossing outs as he was writing it. It's very interesting. The study of the Rambam's manuscript that Rabbi Salman Sassoon Alav HaShalom made, studied and published a study on that, because the Sassoon family owned one edition, part of the Pirush HaMishnayot of the Rambam. Very interesting. So we have no doubt this is not a matter subject to dispute. This is the Rambam's statements. This is his words. As God lives, this group destroys the glory of the Torah and extinguishes its light, for they make the Torah of God say the opposite of what intended, for he's done his perfect Torah. The nations who hear of these statutes, it's set in the Torah in Perashat Beit Hanan. It says, the nations who hear of these statutes shall say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. Am nabon v'hacham ha'goya gadol hazeh. But this group expounds the laws and the teachings of our sages in such a way that when the other people hear them, they say that this little people is foolish and ignoble. You say, the word that the Rambam uses is they'll say, Am sachal v'nabal ha'goya katan hazeh. The worst offenders are preachers who preach and expound to the masses what they themselves do not understand. The translator says preachers, but you can substitute different words if you like. Would that they keep silent about what they do not know, as it is written, if only they would be utterly silent, it would be accounted to them as wisdom in Iyov. Or they might at least say, we do not understand what our sages intended in this statement, and we do not know how to explain it. But they believe they do understand, and they vigorously expound to the people what they think rather than what the sages really said. They therefore give lectures to the people on the tractate Berachot, and on this present chapter, Berachot is also full of agadot. And this present chapter of Koser Shohelek and other texts, expounding them word for word according to their literal meaning. Okay, the second group is also a numerous one. It too consists of persons who, having read or heard the words of the sages, understand them according to their simple literal sense. But what's the difference between the two groups, the second group, and believe that the sages intended nothing else than what may be learned from their literal interpretation? Inevitably, they ultimately declare the sages to be fools, hold them up to contempt, and slander what does not deserve to be slandered. They imagine that their own intelligence is of a higher order than that of the sages, and that the sages were simpletons who suffered from inferior intelligence. The members of this group are so pretentiously stupid that they can never attain genuine wisdom. Most of those who have stumbled into this error are involved with medicine or astrology. They regard themselves as cultivated men, scientists, critics, and philosophers. How remote they are from true humanity compared to real philosophers. They are more stupid than the first group. Many of them are simply fools. The reason it is much worse than the first group is because these people are thinking that the sages believe all of this literally. Now, the sages we're talking about, the Talmudic sages, we're talking about from the year 200 of the Common Era until 500 or 600 of the Common Era. That's the close of the Talmud. We could say it's not exactly a matter that you can just put a line and say after that it's no longer Talmudic. We're not sure, but there's a period, a little bit of flexibility on this. There's a period, a short period, that between 500 and 6 something or so. So we could say the Talmudic period is for about 400 years. And those are the rabbis that we're discussing at this time, that the Rambam is referring to. Now, we'll go further. This is an accursed group because they attempt to refute men of established greatness whose wisdom has been demonstrated to competent men of science. If these fools had worked at science hard enough to know how to write accurately about theology and similar subjects, both for the masses and for the educated, and if they understood the relevance of philosophy, then they would be in a position to understand whether the sages were in fact wise or not, and the real meaning of their teachings would be clear to them. There is a third group, and that's it. There's three groups. First group takes everything literally and believes it's wonderful, and they think the rabbis were great, and hey, all these literal things. Second group takes it literally but thinks the rabbis were fools.
Who is the second group?
Excuse me?
Who is the second group?
No,
the first
group. Oh, the second group, they didn't live on. They're just people in the Jewish nation who, the Rambam's writing, don't forget, he's writing this in 1160.
Yeah, so who will be some of the acclaimed members of this group?
No. I don't think the Karaites would be necessarily this group, because the Karaites, they disagreed with the rabbis in Thresh of Al-Fir. But I think that in the Jewish world, I don't know who they are, because they didn't live on to us. The people in our nation of 800 years ago who took things literally but thought the rabbis were fools. It'll be like today, there are people around today who, when they hear these things, they think that we believe them. Let's say, now, it happens to be, today we have a problem that I don't like to discuss early in the evening. I'd rather discuss it in another half hour or so from now. We have people today who teach these matters literally, and people who hear them think that they're fools, because how can you believe these things literally? I gave an example before.
Yeah, they don't believe that they're literal. This same group believes they're literal, but they don't believe the sages.
Right. No. They believe the sages meant them literally. They don't believe in them.
Oh.
The second group doesn't believe in these things. They say it's all foolish. It's nonsense. They don't believe in these things. Yes.
Okay, but wouldn't it be possible the first group corresponds to the ultra right and the second group
corresponds
to the ultra left, perhaps even of today?
Right. I would think that. That's correct. I would think that's right. Like the ultra-right today, the ultra-right orthodox, they've been taking, like the arts grove people, they take everything literally, it looks like. I mean, I shouldn't say that. They don't take everything literally. They take a lot of things literally. And then the left, say in the reformed world, they look at all these statements. They say, oh, those were statements that they believed in the time, foolish things, because they had no real knowledge, had no sophistication, and they believed those things then, right? And the third group that the Rambam is going to speak about, which is his group...
It seems that the Rambam has no qualms about using derogatory terms for those people who disagree with him. He's quite liberal, it seems.
Right. Right. I mean, he couldn't help but speak the truth that they're darkening the glory of the Torah, the brilliance of the Torah, and they're making our nation look foolish to the world. Okay, let's go further, because... Oh, thank you. Let's go further. There is a third group. Its members are so few in number that it is hardly appropriate to call them a group, except in the sense in which one speaks of the sun as a group or species of which it is the only member. This group consists of men to whom the greatness of our sages is clear. They recognize the superiority of their intelligence from their words, which point to exceedingly profound truths. Even though this third group is few and scattered, their books teach the perfection which was achieved by the authors and the high level of truth which they had attained. The members of this group understand that the sages knew as clearly as we do the difference between the impossibility of the impossible and the existence of that which must exist. They know that the sages did not speak nonsense, and it is clear to them that the words of the sages contained both an obvious and a hidden meaning. Thus, whenever the sages spoke of things that seem impossible, they were employing the style of riddle and parable, which is the method of truly great thinkers. For example, the greatest of our wise men, Solomon, began his book, that's Mishlei, by saying, to understand an analogy and a metaphor, the words of the wise and their riddles. All students of rhetoric know the real concern of a riddle is with its hidden meaning and not with its obvious meaning. As, let me now put forth a riddle to you, that since the words of the sages all deal with supernatural matters which are ultimate, they must be expressed in riddles and analogies. Right? They're dealing with these deep topics, profound topics, the ultimate matters, supernatural. So they speak in riddles and analogies. How can we complain if they formulate their wisdom in analogies and employ such figures of speech as are easily understood by the masses, especially when we note that the wisest of all men did precisely that under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, Ruach HaKodesh, have in mind Solomon of Proverbs, the Song of Songs, and parts of Ecclesiastes, that's Kohelet, Shir Hashirim, Mishlei. It is this that he says parts of Kohelet. It's very interesting that it says parts of, but that's not for tonight. It is often difficult for us to interpret words and to educe their true meaning from the form in which they are contained so that their real inner meaning conforms to reason and corresponds with truth. This is the case even with the Holy Scriptures. The sages themselves interpreted scriptural passages in such a way. Now, the sages of the Talmud interpreted the Torah, that's what he's saying now, the sages interpreted scriptural passages in such a way as to educe their inner meaning from literal sense, correctly considering these passages to be figures of speech, just as we do. Examples are their explanations of the following passages. He smote the two altar hearths of Moab. He went down also and slew a lion in the midst of a pit. Oh, that one would give me water to drink of the well of Bethlehem when it was in enemy territory and they had to go just to get water. The entire narrative of which these passages are a part was interpreted metaphorically. The Gemara interprets these verses as metaphors. Similarly, the whole book of Iyov, the book of Job. We say Job was a man who suffered terribly, and he has his thoughts recorded, he and his friends in discussions, and then God gets involved toward the end. And in the Talmud, there is an opinion that Iyov is it's a prophetic work, but it's a fictional person. It's written in prophecy about a man who may never have lived. But that's an argument in Talmud. But the Rambam is saying, take a look what they say about that. It was considered by many of the sages to be properly understood only in metaphoric terms. But There never was a person, Eov. It's writing in theory. It doesn't lose any of its magnificence. As a matter of fact, many hold it gains, because when you write it as fiction, you can write everything exactly the way you'd like it to be, as under prophecy.
But also, when you read it and you think it's literal, you tend to become part of that second group. You say that it's a little hard to believe that Satan went to before God and requested this and God agreed. You know, so you become a little skeptical when you read it and somebody doesn't.
Well, you could take the Satan part, that first chapter, you could take that part metaphoric and take the rest of it literal. Let's take the next one. The bones of Ezekiel. Also, Ezekiel is in this large field, and there's a lot of dead bodies in the field, absolutely dead bodies, dried up dead bodies. And God tells him, you're going to see now a great thing happen, and then you start seeing movement, and bones are meeting up with bones, and ligaments, and cartilage, and skin is coming around them, and all of a sudden they stand up, and they're all alive. Resurrection! Tehiyat HaMetim. So the Rambam says the dead bones of Ezekiel were also considered by one of the rabbis to make sense only in metaphoric terms. Similar treatment was given to other passages of this sort. Now, if you read it, belong to either... Okay, we're going to stop reading the Rambam now because it's 9 o'clock, and we'll go to these other sheets that are here. I need one copy. Okay, that's it. Okay. On interpreting Midrash, and when they called me today in the afternoon, they asked me, so I said, I'll be very happy to come tonight, but what I feel, whenever I speak about the Rambam on Midrash, I've written a small study with a collection of Midrashim, and I approached it from the point of view of the Rambam. So we might as well do this tonight. I mean, Dr. Azar probably read this on some occasion in the past. On interpreting Midrash, the Mishneh sages comment on the Amalek passage of Perashat Bishlach. The reason I wrote on that Perashat was because there's a very interesting comment, exactly what the Rambam just said, but applied to a different verse or a different passage in the Torah. In other words, the Rambam pointed out that if the sages of the Talmud interpret the Torah as a metaphor, so isn't it logical that they expect that we will interpret some of their words as metaphors? That's what the Rambam said over here. He brought down some verses from today. I mean, it sounds logical. If they think that the Torah itself, the Chumash, some of those verses are not to be taken literally, and they interpret it accordingly, so they are probably expecting that we'll interpret some of their words that way.
Almost goes without saying, because
he is dealing with the Torah, he's dealing with God's words. So, of course, sages would have the right to do that. So what I did is I selected a famous Mishnah interpretation of the Torah. This is in the Mishnah of Rosh Hashanah, not even a Gemara, this is a Mishnah, which is even a higher level. And they interpret a passage that has to do with Amalek. You all heard of Amalek just before Purim, and on Purim Day itself, we read about Amalek. The Mishnah sages comment on the Amalek passage of Perashat Bishalach is an excellent example of their, the sages, that is, unwillingness to accept the Torah passage literally when it conflicted with their sense of logic and common sense. Because in the Amalek story, it says like this. Moshe goes up to the top of the mountain, and Aharon and Hur are with him, and Hur is Miriam's son, say. And when he lifts his hands, Israel is successful. And when he lowers his hands, Amalek is successful. And Moshe's hands were getting heavy toward the end of the day, and they brought him a stone to sit on, because when you're standing, you raise your hands very hard. When you're sitting, you raise your hands also very hard. Keep your hands up all the time. Moshe's hands are up, Israel is victorious. When he puts his hands down, Amalek is victorious. So Aharon and Hur, what they decide to do, they're supporting his hands to keep them up. Sometimes I see people trying to keep their hands holding a talit over a bride and groom's, and they can't hold it more than 5 minutes. That's about the maximum. After that, then we tell them, just let the talit lie and you can take your hands off, because they can't. How long can you hold your hands up? So Moshe is trying to hold it up that whole battle. Okay, and then that's the story will end, that Yeshua is successful to weaken Amalek.
Is that the final test, when it's what's for logic and common sense?
Well, those are my words. If you like to add to them, I mean, the Rambam said if you study science, if you study theology, they'll understand that those words are. But I didn't think I wanted to use those words. So I thought that the defining term in science would be logic and common sense. But you're right. There should be another word there. Empirical evidence should be...
More than that, by definition, a numerical, would necessitate as metaphorical...
No, but not if God tells you I'm making a miracle and it fits into the pattern of what's going on. If God says I'm going to intervene in Egypt and take you out from there with miracles, if God's telling us that, so the Rambam would say that doesn't conflict, because in theology the Rambam would say God has the ability to perform a miracle. But to say that when Moshe is on a mountaintop and he lifts his hands and Israel wins, and if you want to say it's a miracle against common sense, because what type of miracle is that? To say that two groups of, why did they have to go battle down there? It's all superficial, or it's all a farce, that it's all Moshe's hands. Moshe's hands are winning a war, losing a war. I mean, it goes against common sense. It doesn't fit in to any pattern that we could say God's intervening in human affairs with a miracle. When he tells you he's doing that, that can fit in with our understanding of the world and of his divine providence. But you can't understand Moshe lifting his hands and lowering his hands. So some people say, well, today they'll say, not necessarily people who are committed to the sanctity of the Torah, but they'll say maybe the Torah is just using some of those ancient beliefs that you'll find in the ancient world. But that would be something like we would say of the left wing, the reformed, the secular world. They might, because they might be approaching the Torah without recognizing its sanctity. The Rambam says if they would read it carefully and so on, they'd appreciate it. So therefore I chose these two words of logic and common sense to substitute for science, which is what the Rambam actually says. And
I just wanted to understand that Pandora's box with the real thing, specifically the Bereshit, with Noah, the Korach, with the clouds, and things of that nature.
Okay, it's true. It does open up. I don't call it so much a Pandora's box, but I say that it does open many things to interpretation, and the Rambam comments on a good number of those things. Noah was not a problem in the Rambam's days. Nobody up until a couple hundred years ago ever thought that the flood was a problem, but other things were interpreted allegorically. It's true, not by the Rambam alone, by a whole slew of great rabbis. But let's leave that for now. So it's an excellent example. Now, is it possible, they ask in the Mishnah, Rosh Hashanah, chapter 3, 8, that Moshe's raising and lowering his hands governed the ups and downs of the battle? Bechi yadav shel Moshe, or sot melchama, or shavrot melchama, that's the Mishnah. And so they proceeded to interpret it allegorically. Now, that concerned a biblical passage.
The allegory
was, when the Torah says Moshe raises hands, it doesn't mean Moshe's raising his hands. It means whenever Israel turned their hearts to the Almighty in prayer, they're successful. And Moshe's lowering his hands is when you do not turn your heart in prayer, in a battle, in a crisis, in an emergency, and you rely on yourself, and you don't, because raising the hands was always the sign of prayer. So that's what the Mishnah says. These verses at the end of Parashat Bishalach, in the battle against Amalek, are not to be thought of as limited just to that one single battle, but it's a principle that applies for all time, And it's that whenever we're in a problem situation, like a battle, like a war, we have to make sure we turn our hearts in prayer upward to God. And if we don't, we're not successful. If we do, we're successful. That's what the Mishnah says on this verse, on this passage. And I'm sure that through the centuries, everybody in the traditional world accepted that interpretation. There's nobody who disagrees with the Mishnah saying it. First of all, it's logical in the Torah to say an allegorical interpretation. And second, it's saying an interpretation that goes exactly with the mainstream of Jewish thought. So this was accepted. Now you see that the sages of the Mishnah interpreted the Torah in a way that the Torah is giving you a metaphor. So now, following the Rambam, I'm just using a different verse, a different series of verses than the Rambam used, because this happens to be from the Torah, where the Rambam is brought from the Bayani. Yes.
But that example is very, palatable. Like, we can accept that. We can say, we can almost say, that's really what it meant. But we don't have to. We're not bound to say that the Mishnaic interpretation is what really happened. Right?
Right. You're not bound to the Mishnah interpretation. It's an interpretation.
And we can almost say that we don't really know.
But it doesn't matter. Once we see that the sages... Right. Once we see that the sages made such an interpretation, that gives us the right to interpret the sages' words in an allegorical way.
Just using that as a model.
Right. Just using it as a model. Yes.
So the Mishnah doesn't actually say that Moshe wasn't raising his hands.
That's true, but...
Like, he was raising his hands, people were looking at his hands and then praying.
Right, the Mishnah does say, are Moshe's hands what are doing the thing? Moshe's hands are winning the war, losing the war. It doesn't look like it's his hands, so it's a praying. Okay, the Mishnah, you could interpret the Mishnah that the people, while they're fighting with Amalek, they're looking to the top of the mountain and looking up to...
While Moshe was praying, they were in the woods. When he wasn't praying, they're losing.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's very superficial. I mean, it is a very superficial understanding of the Mishnah, in my opinion. I mean, but I'm sure Rabbi Ricky is not wrong. You could say that. We'll go back to Dr. Azar. He says you could interpret the verses a little differently, if you like.
I don't know what an alternate
right. Okay. But Rabbi Ricky is giving an alternate to the way I'm saying it. Because I'm saying that this is telling you when they raise hands, their own hands means when they pray, when they don't pray. But I don't think that if you were monitoring Moshe's hands and you were monitoring the war, you'll find them that they were coordinated, that when one was happening, when his hands up, they were victorious, and when his hands down, they were defeated. I don't think that would be the case. Rabbi Ricky is saying, but you could interpret it that way. Technically speaking, you're right. I don't think that's the right way to interpret the Mishnah, but you could say that.
Just in praying again, we give them inspiration.
Right, so they're looking there, they get confident, and then they're successful. And then when his hands are down, they lose their confidence, and then I'm like, they're successful. It just sounds too pat, and it doesn't...
The Rambam's original writing, I don't think there is a choice, because he said in the first group, if you take it literally, you're converting the word of Tahan, use rather strong language.
Right.
So do we necessarily have a choice? Because if we do it as we want to, strict literal reading on it, then according to the Rambam's words, you're converting the word of Tahan.
Right.
So does a choice really exist?
What do you mean? The Rambam is saying there's no choice. You must do it this way. But a lot of the people are not paying attention to the Rambam. Yeah, the Rambam's been absolutely.
Everything has to be interpreted. Nothing is taken literally.
No. Anything of the sages. Now, I'm not talking about the Torah's words. I only gave an example of the Torah that the sages interpreted the Torah's words as a metaphor in this case. But I'm not talking about the Torah tonight. Tonight, the topic of discussion is Midrash. And those are the words of the sages.
But based on what he's saying, in other words, there are parts of the Torah that say literal.
Right. No. Only those things that a person... No, the Rambam was really speaking about the words of the sages over there. I mean, he even recognized that the Rambam was speaking about the words of the sages. The Rambam brought an example from the Torah where the sages interpreted the words of the Torah in an allegorical way.
But you could take that literal if you would like, you know.
Now, that particular one that the sages said don't take literally because it's against common sense and against logic, there's no simple way that you can get out of that. I mean, there's no way, not even a simple way. You just can't get out of that. It doesn't make sense. And if you interpret that literally, the Rambam would feel that you're being foolish. You're going against the rabbis who say, don't take it literally. The rabbis themselves are saying, don't take that literally. Some of the other examples that the Rambam gave, they're disputed matters in the Gemara. For instance, the one of Iyov, that's a dispute. The one of the Tehillat HaMetim, that's a dispute. Was the resurrection literal or was it allegorical? Well, it's an argument in the Gemara. Was Iyov a man who lived or didn't live? The Rambam's examples there, he says, I don't have to bring you an example that everybody agrees upon. The other ones, everybody agrees upon. Those pesukim came from the Bayamim, that these heroes of God, these unbelievable things that they did, those were allegorical. And Shmuel Elbet, you have it also similar to in the Bayamim. But the Gemara was Doresh, the Bayamim one. That's why he brought that down. But I don't want to make, I don't want to leave any confusion here. The topic is the words of the sages. The Rambam felt that it's appropriate to bring down some cases where the words of scripture are being interpreted allegorical by the sages. And in those cases, some were matters of dispute among the rabbis and some were matters that there was a consensus on. I'm bringing you one that there's a consensus on, the one from Bishalach. The Rambam didn't bring this one down, but it's just as good as the other ones, and it's in the Torah. Yes.
Doesn't Rambam say once something is interpreted as taken allegorically, anything can be taken in the Torah allegorically?
No, he doesn't say that. To my knowledge, never says it anywhere. I've never heard of it. No.
You open the door that it's possible if you want to take everything literal, that's one thing. If you open the door, then you have to have the door open for other explanations.
Well, some people said that. Detractors of the Rambam said it. Opponents said it. Not the Rambam, no.
They use that against him.
Yeah, they use it against him. But I never heard the Rambam say that. I doubt if the Rambam said that. Maybe some people who are in a polemic, when they're arguing one side against the other side, they'll say, even the Rambam would say that. But that's only a polemical statement. I don't think the Rambam ever made that statement anyway. I mean, I never saw it, and Rabbi Ricky, you ever see that? Anybody ever see such a statement of the Rambam? Never. It doesn't fit with his whole philosophy, and it doesn't fit. I'm sure he never said it. Maybe somebody said he said it in order to quiet a class down or individual down or something. Okay, so now, you know what we'll go further. This study, the end of the first paragraph, this study will address the subject and interpretation of rabbinic statements of Midrash and Agadah, and that's it. We're only focusing on rabbinic statements of Midrash and Agadah, and support its thesis with examples from the classical works of the sages focused on Parashat Bishalach. In his introduction to Parashat, now, all I'm going to say over here, but we're going to read it. You know why? Because even though it's the same material we just went over now, but you read a different translation now. In his introduction to Perek Chelek, in a statement regarding how to approach rabbinic midrash and agadah, the latter term usually doesn't have the Talmudic midrashim, a pursuit in which intellectual integrity requires a great deal of non-literal interpretation. Otherwise, you don't have intellectual integrity if you don't go to the non-literal. Harambam points out, many other authorities have similar views, but Harambam's presentation is sufficient for our purposes, that the Mishnah sages themselves assume that even the Torah text must be read with logic and common sense. When confronted with a passage that looked impossible to take literally, they resorted to allegorical interpretation. He cites several examples. We just read these, the Chronicles, some amazing deeds of King David's warriors, such as killing a lion in the pit on a snowy day, which the sages took allegorically, the Book of Job narrative. That means to say the existence of that man and the resurrection account in the book of Ezekiel were also so interpreted by some sages. How much more so is it imperative to be rational when dealing with their own teachings, the agadic and the drashic statements of rabbinic authority? As regarding those who interpret all agadot and drashim literally, he states there, they destroy the Torah's glory and darken its brilliance. They make God's Torah the opposite of what it was then. A much smoother translation than the other one. He stated in the perfect Torah regarding the nations who hear about all these statues, they will say, what a wise and insightful people this great nation is. That's what the Torah says. But when the nations hear how this group relates to the words of the sages in a literal manner, they will say, what a foolish and ignorant people this insignificant nation is. None of these expounders explain to the public what they really do not understand, whether they be quiet or say, we don't understand what the rabbis mean in this statement or how to interpret it. But they think they understand and endeavor to make known according to their poor understanding, not according to the sage's intention, and expound at the head of the assembly, the Rishot of Berachot. In his guide, the guide to perplex. Now remember, there's significant amount of time between the two, because Pirush Mishnayot was first, then there's Mishneh Torah, and then there's the guide. The guide maybe came out perhaps in 1190, and the Pirush Mishnayot came out maybe in 1163 came out.
He was 33.
He was born, they think, 1135.
They say he wrote it from the age of 23 to 33.
Right, so if he's 33, that's 1165. 1165.
That's what you said.
Yeah. So there's a good part of his life between coming out with Pirush Mishnayot to the Moreh Nevuchim. The Moreh Nevuchim, he came out, he was probably 1190, they think, that it came out. So, over there he writes the following. I quote, he added, because it just moves along with the right flow. Our sages use the Bible text as a kind of poetical language for their own ideas. This is not my translation, by the way. This is Friedlander. And do not intend thereby to interpret the text. This style was widespread in ancient days, all adopted in the same way as poets, I'll so to say, in reference to the words, you should have a yatid, like a spade, a paddle, you should have with your weapons. Do not read azinecha, because when a person has to relieve himself, he's in the army, you have to have a holy camp. A person has to relieve himself, so you go outside the camp, you dig a little ditch, you dig a little, relieve yourself, cover it again. Therefore, in your weapons that you carry, this is the Torah writing, in your weapons you carry, make sure you have a little spade that you could dig with so that you can keep your camp holy. Now, the rabbis take that word and they say, Altakeh azinecha, ela oznecha, and the yatir should be like your finger, because that little spade that comes out. So when you hear Lashon Hara, you should put your finger in your ear and not hear Lashon Hara. Now, so you say in reference to the words in a paddle or yatid that shall have upon thy weapons, do not read as in Echa. Don't read it the way the Torah we read it, thy weapon, but Oznecha, thy ear. If you hear a person uttering something disgraceful, put your finger into your ear. Now, I wonder, and I'm not speaking now, I wonder whether those ignorant persons who take the sage's interpretation literally believe that the author of this saying gave it as a true interpretation of the verse quoted, and as the meaning of this precept. I cannot think that any person with intellect or sound can admit this. The author employed the text as a beautiful poetic phrase in teaching an excellent moral lesson. A tremendous lesson. Always be on guard. Always be prepared to protect yourself from having to be subject to slander and gossip and undermining of people. Always have amongst your tools, always have something prepared. So you have your finger, you put it in your ear, you can stop hearing. And you put both fingers in both ears. I mean, that's what the rabbis say from that pasuk in the Torah. But nobody ever dreamt that the rabbis believed that that's what the pasuk in the Torah is saying. The Torah was speaking about the army, about keeping your camp holy, and about having your weapons. And amongst your weapons, you should have this yatid, and you should use it to dig when necessary. And it happens to be coincidentally that the word azinecha, it sounds like oznecha, like your ears, but it doesn't mean your ears, azinecha, it's your weapon. So
it's actually an emendation of the vowel sounds, right?
Right.
Is there a technical meaning for that?
Al tikre halichot ela halachot. Al tikre banaich.
So that's what they call that category.
The rabbis are called Al-Tikre.
But do I not stand correct when I say there's no choice? that we must view it allegorically when, or metaphorically when it's in contrast to logic? I mean, he's now applying an instrument to the words of the sages. He's applying to the text.
No, no, he's applying to the sages. He's saying the sages did not really mean that you could read the text of the Torah the way they say. They mean it metaphorically. The sages did not mean that the Torah is speaking about your finger to be placed in your ear.
And if you were to interpret it in such a
way... As your finger placed in your ear? Nobody does.
Right.
Even the ultra-right wing doesn't interpret it that way. Nobody does. Nobody thinks... You read the Torah, nobody... You just can't get away with that one. That one is just too stark. Nobody does.
But the point still being that so there's no choice. You must...
I don't know. This business of no choice, we have to go slow with this no choice business. Because we're not going to be able to say no choice and then we're going to go see that there's thousands of people who are doing it and we say they don't have a choice. They have a choice. I mean, there's no choice. I mean, technically, legally, if they want to follow the Torah, the points of Rambam's definitions, they have no choice. But, like, you have no choice. So you should follow, right? You should follow what the Torah really requires. You don't really have a choice, but you have a choice. They do it. They do it all the time. So it becomes a little subtle at that point. They don't have a choice means that they're required to understand that the sages were met. That's why he brought this example down over here, to show you that the sages sometimes say things that everybody agrees. So if you agree here, why not agree there? If there's another case that goes against common sense and logic, but not to as great extent as this one, so be open to the possibility, at least, because in another case you do accept it, such as in this case. He brought this case down. Some people will tell you, "Al tikre halichot el halachot," since we say it in the praise every day. So some people say they're so accustomed to it that they've been taking it literally. But no, we don't take it literally. There's so many of these, we don't take them literally. Anyway, let's go a little further. In the same sense, you must understand the phrase, "Do not read so, but so," wherever it occurs in the Midrash. Whenever it says, "Al tikre this, ela that." Now, that's the guide. As the methodology employed in these parashah studies, I'm speaking now, accords with this general perspective, that's the general, my orientation, so as I call it, so, and as unfortunately numerous traditional adherents of the Torah uncritically subscribe to the literalist view of Midrash and Agadah, often disturbed by other approaches that don't like people to have the Rambam's approach, this is an appropriate opportunity to comment on the matter. So, I'm going to comment.
It's this
parasha, because of this. This is an appropriate opportunity. So I'm going to make a comment now. The formulations of the sages teach all sorts of valuable lessons. Frequently they use the Torah text as a springboard to elaborate an idea or as a memory device to anchor an insight, often engaging in moral education and inspirational edification that in their days would have been difficult to transmit in a straightforward manner. It's sometimes very hard to transmit certain things straightforward. As long as the reader, listener realizes that a proposed interpretation of a text is not necessarily its true meaning, often having no connection to the straightforward intention of the relevant verses, as long as you know that, no harm's done. And that the highly improbable, often fantastic, and sometimes impossible realities portrayed are not literal, as long as you know all this, then there's no harm done. No harm is done, and the benefit is derived from the lesson. It's so nice to hear some of these midrashim. People all the time love to, they go to movies, they watch TV, and they read books, and they love it, even if they know it's fiction, but they love it because they get into it and they learn a lesson from it. So there's nothing wrong with giving a midrash, but as long as the people know that they're watching or they're listening or they're reading a fiction, and then you get the message and it's beautiful, so there's no harm done. The midrash is beautiful, but don't make the mistake when you finish to now go back and think you learned history and that's the way it was. So therefore, that's what I say in this paragraph. And I might even go a step further. It may also be contrary to Harambam's stated position, may go even further than Harambam, that when they felt it necessary to do so, some sages utilized such methods even when they knew their audience thought that the literal message they expounded was intended to explicate the meaning of the passage. Now, in other words, sometimes they utilized such methods even when they knew their audience thought that the literal message was intended to explain the passage. Even when they're mistaken, even when the audience think it's literal and that's the real meaning. I think the sages, different than Harambam says, I think the sages sometimes gave a midrash knowing that the people will take it literally. Some of those borderline cases, they knew they'll take it literally, but it still was necessary. This would have been probable when dealing with minimally educated people who lived in societies and contexts that precluded them from access to scientific knowledge about reality or historical knowledge about events, such that their taking an impossible interpretation literally created no conflict for them and only provided the benefit of the lesson. There was no conflict. They didn't know anything about science. They weren't educated. And in order to give them some moral instruction, it could be the rabbis made some midrashim for them, very likely. That's what I think. That's maybe contrary to the Rambam's position. I don't know if the Rambam goes to that extent.
What would the purpose be over there? I think
the purpose would be like go to movies and you read books.
No, but here to make them believe that it's the
No, they don't make them believe. No, they don't make them believe. They just know they're running the risk of the people
running the risk. They don't fear that risk.
No, but they don't fear it. They probably even know that the people will take it literally sometimes.
The benefit would outweigh the
risk. In some places, yes, the benefit outweighs the risk by far, because those were societies very static, where people were farmers and small craftsmen, and they were busy all day, subsistence economies, that people had very little time in certain societies, certain cities through history, some places in the world today, maybe the majority of the world today live that way. The people have very little leisure, they don't have a chance to get educated. You get educated as a child, 13 years old, the kid's bar mitzvahed, and he's working, and there's very little chance. But to give moral education, the midrash is the most powerful tool. It's very hard to substitute for a beautiful story that carries a moral. We'll see a few nice stories now in a few minutes.
But when you get to something like Ayin Taka Ayin,
that's
something that, if it's interpreted literally,
I agree.
You get a completely different picture, and I'm wondering, wouldn't it have been better to perhaps put it in a different language that doesn't lend itself so easily
now to interpretation? Now you're asking about the Torah. I told you, it's not our topic tonight. That's the Torah. That's God's department. Now we're dealing with the sages. And I'd like to stay focused on the sages. Your question should be an evening that Merkaz can bring the speaker down and speak about the Torah, the literalness in the Bible itself. That's a big question. And like you said before, Bereshit and Noah, those all go into that same category of the Torah itself. But that's not tonight's topic. Now, but let's read the bottom of this page too. But with the immense advances in knowledge in recent centuries, the most basic general education nowadays, indeed merely being an alert individual living in modern society, anybody who, I don't know, if they read Newsweek, if they, people, whatever they do, they become educated eventually. If they don't go to school, I know that's the way it is today. Living in modern society provides an enormous amount of information and sophistication about many subjects that the Midrashim continually touch upon. An average person can hardly not be impacted as the mass media are involved in this process. And many people are now accustomed to read widely. Some people, they read widely and critically. Some people, they think rationally and approach knowledge with intellectual integrity. Today, as has been the case for well over a century, taking Midrashim and Agadot literally tends to cause prodigious conflicts in sincere individuals between their religious faith and their knowledge of reality. See, today, if you don't follow the Rambam's prescription, a lot of people will be conflicted, because you don't follow the Rambam, you take the Midrash literally, but today the people are educated. People just, I mean, it's incredible. Just go to high school. I mean,
the irony is that this phenomenon
isn't this phenomenon of taking the Midrash Shem literally almost a recent phenomenon?
It's ironic. Not exactly, because the Rambam is complaining
only
in the 12th century.
I'm glad I asked that question.
No, but if you look at the Rishonim that write about it, the oldest idea is to agree with the Rambam, and even the most Ashkenazi. It's just a couple of mistakes that seem really. The rabbis weren't teaching that.
It wasn't so much on this, it was on other views of the Rambam. The Rambam had a number of very controversial views. This is not very controversial. I mean, this man, Rabbi Ricky, is saying it's not even controversial, this one, but he has other views that are controversial, different subjects, which we're not going to discuss now. So now we'll go further. Let's read the next paragraph. This is all on the Rambam stuff, but what I'd like to do, it's getting late, but I'd like to do is to take a couple of examples. But this is a very important paragraph. Attempts to avoid the difficulties have generally promoted apologetics with numerous false harmonizing resolutions. See what they do? They make up answers all the time. The people who take it literally, they make up answers. And that's apologetics, with numerous false harmonizing resolutions that for many, particularly the brighter, more educated, intellectually oriented members of society, it merely postpones the problems for a time. While the boy is in high school, they could postpone the problem. Maybe they could postpone it another couple of years, but at a certain point, that's it. You can't keep postponing the problem. The problem is there. They say the rabbis are making statements that are impossible if you take the anti-Rambam point of view. Merely postpone. All this contributed, now I'm speaking about history of the past century or two centuries, all this contributed to mass defection from tradition on the one hand, and the development of defensive measures to preclude exposure to contradictory knowledge on the other. The latter often includes discouragement, if not prohibition, of advanced general studies. Don't go to college. Don't read books. Right. If not prohibition of advanced general studies, insisting the Torah be studied without the benefit of modern scholarly research, as well as strictly limiting interaction with and participation in the life of the wider society. Don't enter the wider society. Don't take a job. They really prefer not even to take a job. Just study Torah your whole life. Because if you take a job, you might interact with people who have knowledge, and that knowledge will threaten your belief in the sanctity of the rabbi's words. This is happening. No, this has happened. That is happening. It has happened already. And we're recognizing many of its effects. That's on one side. The other side is mass defection. You ask people, why did you leave Judaism? One time, a teacher that I had a conversation with was telling me that his whole group left Judaism from Talmud Torah. They went Talmud Torah till their Bar Mitzvah, even young kids, but let's say 40 years ago or something, very bright group of people. This was his friend was a mayoral assistant at the time, and he was a math teacher, like a he said, when we asked the teacher, how can you say, this is the question he told me, I'm not saying that it's such a great question, he's saying, what do you mean that Eve was created from the rib? You mean the woman is made out of a rib and so on? And he said, well, the way the teacher answered him, he said, they all just dropped everything. And it happens, that's it. Anyway, we'll go further. As Harabam stated, oh no, we have to read another sentence over here. Of course, such measures create further serious negative consequences. These measures of, you can't go to college, you can't read the books, you even don't interact with society, live in a ghetto, and all this business, they create further serious negative consequences, impacting on psychological, social, and economic well-being. Well, the economic well-being, that goes without saying. You see, you go to a store today, you see a beautiful young lady in front of you, takes out food stamps to pay. I mean, it's all over the place today. You know, it's really very sad that these families are struggling. So they said, no, we're struggling, we're sacrificing, but they're subjecting their children to tremendous hardships. So we say, okay, so we'll contribute to support the system, but this is not necessarily the proper way that Torah should be studied, that they have to live in a ghetto. I mean, it's an intellectual ghetto, and there's social problems that come out of this, that they can't interact with others. So if two brothers, one goes to college and becomes educated, and his conversation is always that type of conversation, and the other one is another kind, he can't subject his children to his brother, because his children might hear words that will undermine believing in the Midrash literally, because he'll interpret the Midrash allegorically, and if he does, he might undermine the system. And that's social problems and psychological problems, that goes without saying. What does a person do when he's conflicted, when a person knows something and then he's told that it's not that way? And okay, as Harabam stated, when the Torah tends to be allegorical, which it truly at least sometimes does, we must not be distracted by a tendency to literalness, as the Torah's intention is the Peshat, the real meaning. But that is not the subject of this discussion. The teachings of the sages are often clearly recognizable as non-literal. We will provide some. Okay, we just have a few more minutes, so let's look at some examples. Let's take a nice example. I mean, they're all nice examples. There's 10 examples over here from that one parasha. And the reason I focused them all on the same parasha, which was the parasha of the week, of course, but on parasha, that the reader should realize that there's thousands of these, because there's only for one parasha. Every parasha, there's 54 parashiot in the Torah. Every parasha has numerous midrashim. Every parasha. And these are just 10 from Parashat Bishalach. And there's many, many more Parashat Bishalach. They're all over the place. Every one of them is a beautiful statement. Every one of them is edifying, educational. Every one of them has a lesson that we all should take to heart, but not to take it literally. That's the bottom line. So we'll take one. Well, we could take we'll take two, item two, because a lot of people have heard it because it's in Rashi and so on. Israel exited Egypt Hamushim. What does Hamushim mean? V'hamushim alu b'nei Yisrael me'eres Mitzrayim. Israel exited Egypt Hamushim. The Michelta first interpreted Hamushim as armed, or perhaps provisioned. Provisioned with food, they took out supplies and so on. That's what, when Israel exited Egypt, they took out provisions. And the Michelta is one of the great compendiums of Midrash, usually halachic Midrash. The Michelta is in a very special category because it develops halacha from its Midrash. And it's beautiful. The Michelta, that's on Shemot. And there's two Michiltot, there's Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Ishmael. The Michelta is a beautiful compendium. On this Pasuk, it starts off by saying that Hamushim means armed, I mean, or provision, depends how you do it. And then it brings down the Pasukim from Yeshua, which show that that's what it should be understood, the word Hamushim, because it's found again in Sefer Yeshua. It continues with other explanations. Now, the word Hamushim sounds like Hamesh, or Homesh. It sounds like a fifth, Homesh. So you say, you know what it means? It's another opinion in the Midrash. It means one-fifth of the Jews came out of Egypt. Four-fifths died. Where did they die? We'll read it now. It continues with other explanations. Only one-fifth of the Israelites left Egypt. Some say one in 50 came out. Some say one in 500. The Rabbi Nehorai says not even one in 500. It was one in a larger number even. Because as we expound, they were giving birth to six at a time. Paru, v'yishesu, v'yirbu, v'yasu, v'mod, me'od, v'nisel. Six. Every birth, each woman is having six. And then those kids grow up, and then each girl was having six when she came. You know, over the period of slavery, you have to multiply six. So I said, you can't even do it one. Because you come out 600,000 men, you have, so more than one in 500, more than 499 of 500 died. One second. When did they die? This is all the Michelta I'm reading now. This is all translating the Michelta. When did they die? During the 3 days of darkness. That's the ninth plague. How come during the 3 days of darkness that they all died? Oh, so that Israel buried its dead and gave thanks and praise to the Almighty they were able to bury their dead while the Egyptians couldn't see anything. So they were burying their dead, so the Egyptians shouldn't be able to feel
The Yehudim didn't have darkness.
They didn't have darkness. So the Egyptians would be denied the ability to see the Jews burying their dead. So they died during the darkness. So that Israel buried its dead and gave thanks and praised the Almighty. Israel was able to give praise to the Almighty for these 4 out of 5 that died, or 4 out of 500 that their enemies didn't see and rejoice in their destruction. And then Yakutchim, when he goes a little bit more,
the Jews were able to bury in the darkness.
Yeah, or Bemoshvatam. They didn't have the darkness. That was the great miracle. The B.O.C.S. says, Hamushim, he disagrees with all this. He says it means something else. It means the fifth generation. Dor Revi'i Yashubuhenna. This is the fifth generation. So whatever that explanation is, that's the B.O.C.S. Now, I comment. A lesson is here taught about the valor of a minority who hold fast to their beliefs against the assimilation tendency of the many. You know, if you say 1 out of 5 came out, 4 out of 5 were wicked. They were not deserving of being recipients of God's miracle. 4 out of 5, or 49 out of 50, or 499 out of 500, according to what different opinions in the Midrash. They were not worthy. That one who was worthy, what was life like for him? But he still held up, and he deserved to be redeemed. Don't think that because all the people around you are violating the laws of the Torah, everybody's eating on kosher, and you're 1 out of 500, and you feel foolish, that you're the only one who's holding up the law. Don't worry. Stay firm. God is going to redeem you. It's a beautiful message. When you teach this to people in that society, in a society where there were problems, where the Jews were starting to assimilate, such as we're very familiar with, and you teach the people, say, look, it happened before in our history. Really, it didn't happen. Now, this is all in the Midrash. But you tell them it happened before in our history, and there were 499 wicked Jews violating the laws of Torah and not willing to be redeemed, and the one made it, and that's who came out, 1 out of 5, 1 out of 500, whatever. So that's a great lesson is here taught about the valor of a minority who hold fast to their beliefs against the assimilation tendency of the many, and about the deaths of those who didn't remain faithful. But surely not in interpreting our verse or in describing the historical setting it presents. Let me comment about the history for a moment. The population of the world at that time was much, much smaller than anything that's been in our life. The population of Egypt, I checked on this because of this Midrash. I checked on it once, and I looked around a little bit, did a little study on the subject, and they said the best estimates, the total population of Egypt, total in the times, let's say in the Pharaoh, say 1200 BCE, something like that, which is the detailed time of Yetziat Mitzrayim, was about 4 million. That was the population. Now, if we say 600,000 men came out, if we take numbers literally of the Torah, 600,000 men came out, so you say it's a population with children and women, population of 2 million. So that itself is problematic, to say 2 million Jews came out. And then if you're going to say 1 in 5 came out, so you say, well, there were 10 million Jews and 2 million came out. Then another opinion says 1 in 50, another opinion says 1 in 500. These become absolutely impossible to entertain them literally. But what I'd like to add to this is something which is very important. And that is that if there's a controversy in the Midrash on the subject, that one opinion says it has nothing to do with 5, it has to do with provision. Another opinion says it has to do with 5, but it's the fifth generation. Another opinion says no, it's 1 out of 5, 1 out of 4, 1 out of 50, 1 out of 500. If there's a controversy, so that shows that there's no tradition that that's interpretation. How do the rabbis know that that's the interpretation? Where did they get it from? If we take it literal,
literally. Where do the rabbis know?
Which one should we take?
Which one should we take? And why should even the rabbis think that it's legitimate? How can a rabbi, if he sees the other opinion is conflicting with his and they don't accept this, if he can prove that this is the tradition, well, let him prove it to the rabbis instead of proving it to us. Why can't he convince the rabbis who say that it means provision? Or why can't he convince the rabbis that it means the fifth generation? This is a very important point.
Then,
I cannot underestimate this point.
Why would they argue over it if it wasn't the truth to it? Why would they argue over the 150, 1500?
Well, I'll tell you, I like that question, but it doesn't address my point. It doesn't contradict my point at all. You can't get, whatever your reason, let's say you want to say the consequence of your question you might intend to be, therefore, it was literal. But if it was literal, why couldn't he convince the rabbis? You don't get away from that question. That question stands. Why couldn't he convince the rabbis? And if he couldn't convince his rabbis, why should he convince us? If he couldn't convince, and if one says 1 out of 5, 1 out of 500, if they're arguing that, they don't have a tradition. Why they're arguing, your question doesn't contradict my point. It's a nice question, and we'll talk about it right now. But we will not see it as that serious. Now, why are they arguing? Let's address that question. Why are they arguing? I think
is that really a good word? Is it really arguing? Is
they're not really arguing, but they all know. They know.
One-upping.
Right,
they're one-upping.
One-upping. Right, they're one-upping. They might have been. They might have been. No, that's what the doctor is saying. It's not a true really debate over here.
They're agreeing with each other, but they're right. Agreeing with they're right. Intensifying.
How should we say it over to the public? That's the discussion.
Let's
and maybe there weren't, and maybe they were not even in the same setting. Maybe this is a collection of the statements. Maybe when it says Hamushim, one rabbi in Kol Israel said it's 1 out of 5, and one rabbi in Manhattan Beach says it's 1 out of 50, and this is being collected, and it's not necessarily all in the same context. It might have been a different year. It might have been, these are different, and these might be, that's what I think is a strong possibility about this. But in any event, it doesn't contradict the point that if there's an argument, or let's call it an argument at best for this purpose, it means that they don't have a tradition. They don't have a legitimate tradition. They don't have a tradition that they convince one another. And if they can't convince one another, we ask the question, why should they convince us? Absolutely not. I mean, it's beyond any reason that we should accept it literally if some of their colleagues didn't accept it literally.
Any examples from the Gemara, there's a machloket.
So here's what we say about that. We today, if they have a machloket, two colleagues, and one says tradition from Sinai and the other one doesn't accept it, so we say we don't necessarily know it's a tradition from Sinai. We don't know that because there's a colleague that says it's not like that.
The halacha follows.
Halacha is practical behavior. Everybody knows in every law code in the world, people have to have a decision, and the Torah is no different. We have to have a decision. Therefore, there's a law that a Beit Din, in the old days, there was one Beit Din for the nation, a Sanhedrin. They convene and they decide and they make the law. It doesn't necessarily mean that was what was the reality. They don't change the reality. They may not know what the reality was of previous societies, previous generations or centuries, but the best of their knowledge of these rabbis is that this is the way the law should be. That's fine. Now, actually, your question should be taken into an area where the Rambam directly addresses, and that is that if you're dealing with non-halachic issues that have a halachic consequence, the final halacha doesn't make the theory right or wrong. Like, just to give you a rough example, we'll say if there's an argument, in the Gemara there's an argument, let's say if the resurrection of Yehezkel was literal or allegorical. And if the rabbis got together and they decided it should be taught in a certain way, it should be taught literal, it doesn't make it that it was literal, it just is how we should practice, how we should conduct it. If they got together and they decided this is...
arbitrarily.
It's arbitrary, and we recognize it's arbitrary, and it doesn't affect the reality past. There's no such thing as this now affects what happened 1,000 years before, 2,000 years before. There's no connection. There's no connection to that. It's how we should all get together and conduct. But a person could privately believe that this halakha is really not reflecting what the reality in the past was. That's absolutely the case. Ben Surer Moreh. There's an opinion in the Gemara that there never will be a Ben Surer Moreh. Another opinion says there was.
Can you just say what it is in English?
Right, that's the son who is gluttonous and disrespectful and so on, that the Torah says, no, not just disrespectful, he's rebellious. He's the gluttonous, rebellious son who doesn't listen to his parents, and they take him to Beit Din, they can't do anything, and he's put to death. They never put a Ben Surer to death in our Judaic tradition, in the Talmudic time, in the pre-Talmudic time. They did in Salem, Massachusetts, in the colonial times, they did, just like they used to kill the witches, and they used to do all this. They took a lot of the biblical statements very literally, you know, but those are biblical statements we're talking about. So if the rabbis got together and they say, we're going to posek Ben Surer Moreh today, they decide, we find it's good, we're going to Ben Surer Moreh, it doesn't necessarily mean that the other position was wrong, but now they'll be a Ben Surer Moreh, they'll do it. And it won't change what history was and what the real intention was. The opinion that says never be meant that it's there only to be studied and to learn from and never to practice. That was an opinion. Never to practice. But if the rabbis got together at a later century and they said, no, we want to practice it, we think that's the right way, okay, but it won't change history, maybe it's still not to be practiced, but they're wrong, but they'll do it. See, so that's in halakha. When you come to halakha, you don't change reality, you don't change the theology, you don't change the history, but you have to have a way to conduct. And that's what the Beit Din will decide how you should conduct. That's fine. That we never use halakha to impinge on theology. Halakha is its own realm, which particular way you practice. Okay, anyway. Yes, please.
Okay.
Okay, Midrash, now the question and answers.
No, because I'm not that educated. Midrash is interpretation of the Torah.
It's interpretation of the Torah.
And we can't take it always. And the sages make the interpretation.
Right, exactly.
So it doesn't mean we have to believe the interpretations of the sages.
Exactly.
That's what we're saying.
Exactly. Okay. We don't have to believe them literally.
That's what I mean.
Right. We should believe that they're very profound statements, very valuable statements. We could learn a lot from them, but we don't have to take them literally. That's what the Rambam's message is.
Mm-hmm.
You don't take them. But the Rambam tells you, as we read earlier tonight on that page 12, the Rambam tells you that they're the greatest people, those sages. They're masters of wisdom. So don't take their words lightly, but don't take them literally. In an allegorical sense, and as you, if you read these sheets, if you read these 10 examples, you'll get a nice idea of what we're talking about. I just gave you one about that they're teaching you to stand up to the public who might be violators of the law, and they might be influencing, and they might be making it difficult to stay faithful to the Torah, but stay faithful. God will come through for you in the right time, like he did for our ancestors in Egypt. That's say. But is that literal? No, it's not literal. But when a person watches a movie, I haven't been in a movie for many years, but I know that this happens, say, with a good movie. A person watches a good movie, it could give him a moral lesson, in theory, even though he knows he's watching fiction. And he walks away and he could be moved by it. And the Midrash can also move you, and you know that you're receiving a message from the greatest people, from the sages of the Talmud, in the Talmudic Agadot. You know you're receiving a message, and the message is very valuable, but
it's not necessarily literal. So don't build history. Now, there are history books that come out for the high schools and elementary schools, and they're built on the Midrash, taking the Midrash literally. So one day, I went to a book fair for yeshivas in New York, and one of the books being displayed was a history book by Artsgrove. So the salesman was standing around, and he said, "Oh, this is a great book." He's telling me that. So I said, "Okay, let's open a page. Let's see what it says." So we opened a page, and it spoke about the destruction of the first temple, and it gave a year, which is like it gave a year, say 440 or something like that, BCE. So I told him, I said, "You know, everybody knows that it was 586 BCE, but we also know that from certain Talmudic sources, it'll come out 140 years or so later." Mm-hmm. We know that there's certain. So I told him, "How can you write down a Midrashic date when everybody knows?" He says, "Well, the Sephardic, you know, I was from Spark High School." He said, "Spark students don't generally go to college," he told me. So he answered him. "So you shouldn't be bothered by it." I mean, it's terrible. Terrible statement. He said, "You shouldn't be bothered by it." Right. I mean, such a stupid statement. Right. He said, "You shouldn't be bothered by it." I just walked away.
But it's a history book.
A history book. The Art Scroll history book. We opened it up. Now it's the page that came out. The Art Scroll.
If it was a book of Midrashim, that's one thing. But it was being sold as a history book.
I'm sure they're still selling it today. And he bought. Yes.
In fact, we sell books from that genre. And
it's based on it. Isn't it kind of ironic that 2,000 years ago they wrote the Midrashim as a way to convey to uneducated people, you know, stories of, you know, the Bible or whatever, just educating the uneducated by, as you said, like almost like a fiction, like a novel or a movie. But 800 years ago, there was a difficulty in having people understanding it. And now 2,000 years, 800 years later after that, we have this, if not the worst problem. Why was it so easy 2,000 years ago, and why did everyone write in style? As opposed to now, we can't figure it out, and we have people understanding literally, we have people who don't think literally, can't figure out what they're trying to talk about.
I'll comment on that, but not with a tape recorder on.
Okay, thank you.